Hitler's War by David Irving. And so it will be, mein Führer. In 4 years, the wheel had turned full circle. Throughout the winter of 1943 to 44, the Western Front would remain Hitler's constant preoccupation as he devoured intelligence reports and pored over aerial photographs, trying to deduce where the Allies would set foot in Europe and when. More than once he was heard to exclaim that if the Allies established a beachhead, the war was lost for Germany. On November 3, 1943, he underlined this in his directive, number 51, quote, "Now the danger in the East remains, but an even greater one is emerging in the West. The Anglo-American invasion, the sheer vastness of the Eastern spaces allows us to countenance even a major loss of territory if the worst comes to worst, without it striking fatally at Germany's vital arteries. Not so in the West. I can therefore no longer tolerate the weakening of the West in favor of other theaters of war." End quote. Hitler expected the enemy to land near the A-4 rocket sites and the V-1 flying bomb catapults currently being erected along the Channel coast by armies of French laborers. But the political and strategic profit to the Allies of an invasion of Denmark meant that its shoreline would also have to be defended. The Balkans cried out for reinforcements too. The Italian collapse had created pandemonium there. Hitler's attempts to bolster Poglavnik's tottering government in Croatia failed, even though the country now regained the Dalmatian coastline it had lost in 1941 to Italy. Several times during September and October, Hitler conferred with his generals and ministers on the Balkan problem. Field Marshal von Weichs, his commander-in-chief there, reported that while an Allied invasion was unlikely before the spring, quote, "the most dangerous enemy is Tito," unquote. The partisan commander had 100,000 men under arms. In his diary, Weichs wrote, quote, "the grim partisan situation puts a completely different complexion on things. Not that you can speak of, quote-unquote, partisans anymore under Tito. A powerful Bolshevik army has arisen, rigidly led, acting on directives from Moscow, moving from strength to strength and growing deadlier every day. It has strong British support. Tito's present objective is to break into Serbia and then defeat the nationalist guerrillas led by, I can't read that, but D. Mihailovic. End quote. The Italian withdrawal had left a vacuum in Albania, where there was only one German battalion to defend the coastline. If the Allies had landed even one regiment there, they could have controlled the country in 2 weeks. Hitler's response to this situation was a significant political realignment. Supported by Weichs and Kaltenbrunner, he decided to enlist the aid of the Serbs. On October 29th, he vested in Ribbentrop's very able special envoy to the Balkans, Hermann Neubacher, sweeping powers to fight communism there. In particular, he could make contact with Mihailovic if need be. The Serbs were tempted with the restoration of Montenegro, the removal of Goering's notoriously corrupt economic envoy Neuhausen, and special favors for Prime Minister Milan Nedic, a man whom Hitler found he could trust and like. One thing was plain: Hitler could not abandon the strategically important Balkan Peninsula. Thus, he ordered its defense to be tightened along the cordon of islands from the Peloponnese and Crete to Rhodes. Kos was taken in October, and on November 11th, a modest German force landed on the island of Leros, held by 10,000 British and Italian troops, and recaptured it in 5 days. Bloody fighting. Samos was taken on the 22nd, and thus the whole Dodecanese returned to German control, one of the last German victories under Hitler's dictatorship. Hitler hated the Balkans. Quote, "if the British said Germany's job will be to keep the Balkans in order," he said in an illuminating aside at one war conference now, "we'd be busy for the next 30 years marching in and out and back again, banging their heads together and getting out again," end quote. From Himmler's intelligence sources, Hitler knew that the British were applying powerful pressure on Turkey to abandon her neutrality. Himmler's principal source was Cicero, an Albanian manservant employed by Sir Hugh Nachtbohl Hugesson, the British ambassador in Ankara, who had been equipped by the German police attaché L.G. Moisich with a Leica camera, skeleton keys, and large sums of Turkish currency. In return, he was secretly photographing all the British ambassador's papers during the hour or so that the diplomat bathed and breakfasted. Once Moisich was recalled to Berlin and closely questioned about Cicero, who had by now supplied 80 films of top-secret British documents, Moisich confirmed that this agent was indubitably authentic. He hurried back to Ankara on November 9th, as the British ambassador was due back from a meeting in Cairo, where Eden had just spent 3 days talking with the Turkish foreign minister. By the 10th, Ribbentrop had already had Cicero's dispatch, quote, "In Cairo, Eden has demanded Turkish airfields for fighter operations in view of the precarious British military situation in the Aegean," end quote. The Turkish foreign minister refused to discuss Eden's demand. Papen himself lunched with Hitler at the Wolf's Lair on the 17th. Next day, German intelligence sources in Ankara, not Cicero this time, reported that Eden had informed the British ambassador that he had formed a bad impression of the Russian army. It seems to be in confusion and, quote, at the end of its tether, unquote. Hitler hoped that Stalin's army would not last much longer. Quote, "We must not think of it as some kind of medieval giant that gets stronger every time it topples to the ground," he rebuked his generals. "One day its strength must also fail." End quote. On November 1st, 1943, Russian troops again landed in the north and east Crimea, but they were held at bay. On the 3rd, General Hoth's 4th Panzer Army was convincingly breached. The city of Kiev fell, and the Russian advance reached Fastov, 40 miles to the southwest, before grinding to a halt on the 7th. Hitler sacked General Hoth, calling him Jeremiah, unquote. Afterward, he was given details on the cancer of, quote-unquote, defeatism, spreading among Hoth's soldiers. Quote, "His men have only just found the courage to report all this to me," end quote, complained Hitler weeks later. Zietzler commented, quote, "Any army is the image of its commander," end quote. Hitler agreed. This was why he admired such party faithfuls as Koch, Sokol, and Ley, Gauleiters who had in their time converted communist Gau into Nazi party strongholds. Quote, "The good Gau were always under the good Gauleiters," end quote. He was convinced that it was the same way in the army. The rot had now set in. The security service, which censored soldiers' letters home, reported that the men no longer believed in victory. Himmler felt that Manstein was at the bottom of the Eastern Front's defeatism. When Hitler sent for him on November 7th, it was widely believed the field marshal would be retired. Instead, Hitler insisted that Manstein prepare a thrust from the bridgehead at Nikopol toward the Crimea. First, the situation southwest of Kiev had to be restored. Sepp Dietrich's lifeguards began the attack on the 15th, recaptured the city of Zhytomyr, and slid to a halt in the mire after killing 20,000 enemy troops and destroying or capturing 603 tanks, 300 guns, and 1,200 anti-tank weapons. Quote, "Where will it ever end?" wrote Goebbels. "The Soviets have reserves of which we have never dreamed in even our most pessimistic estimates," end quote. On the northern front, squabbles between Kukler and Kluge prevented their adjacent army groups from coordinating their counterattack at Nivel, whose recapture would block the enemy's further advance on Latvia. On November 8th, Kluge reached his objectives, but Kukler refused to attack the next morning as arranged, and Kluge had to retire his opening position. With more than a little truth, Hitler complained, quote, "The whole catastrophe of Nivel can be blamed on the petty selfishness of the two army group commanders," unquote. In mid-November, Hitler discussed with his political advisors the possibility of recruiting more Estonians and Latvians for the defense of their native soil, but Rosenberg pointed out that unless the Baltic states' autonomy was assured, they would be unwilling to spill their own blood for the German cause. Hitler was inwardly opposed to making such far-reaching concessions in difficult times, unquote, Rosenberg wrote afterward. Hitler preferred to drain his own industrial labor force. Milch had himself vowed to him that he could, given the chance, round up 2 million men from the army's rear for the battlefront within 3 weeks, end quote. He complained that of the 8 million German soldiers, barely 260,000 were actually on the Eastern Front. Hitler agreed there was an imbalance, but Goering felt himself so vulnerable because of his sinking prestige that at a conference on November 24th, he actually declared that he was convinced the Luftwaffe had a large number of men to spare. 3 days later, Hitler signed a command for 1 million men to be extracted from the Wehrmacht's fat, quote-unquote fat, and sent to the front line. The practical result, sadly recorded by Schmunt some months later, was a disappointment. Quote, unhappily, it has not been a big success. He added, no use was made of the penal provisions laid down by the Führer. Instead of 1 million men, only 400,000 were extracted. End quote. Goering's prestige was sinking ever lower, because Berlin had now begun to suffer. Night after night, up to 1,000 British bombers assaulted the capital. After the first big raid on November 22, 1943, the government quarter was in ruins. For days on end, the city had no telephones, gas, water, or electric power. The Alkett factory, where most of Hitler's self-propelled assault guns were made, was devastated. On some nights of this series of raids, over 3,000 people died, but the Berliners proved as tough as the people of Hamburg in July and of London 3 years before. In London, some newspapers claimed that a million had died in Berlin and that the whole city was in ruins. For tactical reasons, Goebbels was careful not to deny these claims. Revenge, he reasoned, would soon be theirs. Under Himmler's control, slave laborers were toiling to complete an impregnable underground factory in the Harz Mountains for the manufacture and assembly of the A-4 rocket. Allied bombers had destroyed the first big launching silo at Vatten in northwest France before it was complete. Now Hitler accepted the recommendation of Speer's engineers that a new site be chosen at nearby Visernes. A million-ton dome of concrete would be emplaced on the edge of a chalky quarry first, then the missile launching complex excavated beneath it. Hitler was, quote, unconvinced it would ever be completed, unquote, but his skepticism was dispelled by high-pressure salesmanship from the Peenemünde team, who adroitly covered up the backwardness of the A-4 missile itself. Late in October, as Hitler was being assured that the A-4 would be operational by the end of 1943, the Luftwaffe's new chief of staff, General Gunther Korten, had interrupted, quote, we are aiming at that date too, meaning the flying bomb, but the A-4 was running into problems. Speer learned on November 8th that, quote, the research is not as complete as the development team would have people believe, end quote. Nobody told Hitler that the same day in Munich he was proclaiming, quote, quote, our hour of revenge is nigh, unquote. The Luftwaffe's flying bomb had meanwhile gone into mass production at Volkswagen's Fallersleben factory, but it too was plagued by production faults, and the assembly line halted in November. Despite this, 96 special catapult sites were erected by tens of thousands of French workers and taught engineers along the Channel coast facing England. They would be ready by mid-December 1943, and the two giant launching bunkers would be operational in March. Inspecting the Luftwaffe's latest secret equipment at Insterburg Airfield with Goering on November 26th, Hitler asked an engineer when the flying bomb would be ready. The man replied, quote, by the end of March, end quote. Hitler fell abruptly silent, as the date was the latest he had yet been told. Regardless of these setbacks, on December 15th, he instructed Jodl that the reprisal attack on London was to begin on February 15th, preferably on a foggy forenoon with a barrage of as many missiles as possible. The delays, however, multiplied. Jodl wrote in his diary after seeing Hitler on December 25th, quote, A4 and flying bomb are dawdling. End quote. By that time, the American bomber force had diverted its attentions to the 96 catapult launching sites for the V-1 in France. Soon, 73 had been destroyed. Oof. But now this mattered little, for a new system of prefabricated launchers had superseded them, and the 96 were little more than decoys. Hitler drew much comfort from the fact. Quote, obviously the things are getting on their nerves. If they were to start erecting such things and we knew they were there for... And we knew they were for wiping out Berlin, then we'd get nervous too and set our Luftwaffe on them. End quote. Meanwhile, the Reichsmarshal had sworn to Hitler that within 2 weeks the Luftwaffe would bomb London. He left for France to command the operation in person. Not until January 22nd, however, was a fleet of 462 aircraft assembled for the attack. After the first raid, the British gloatingly announced that only 30 bombers had found their way to London. The wretched Heinkel 177 had suffered heavy losses. Quote, that rattletrap is quite the worst junk ever manufactured, lamented Hitler. It's a flying panther, referring to the equally paralytic tank. And the panther is the crawling Heinkel, end quote. Hitler refused to believe that less than 300 or 400 planes had reached London. Quote, you've got agents, he challenged General Gunther Korten, chief of staff of the Luftwaffe. We find out the most precious secrets of their war councils, their most confidential plans and ideas. But as to whether 3 buildings have been burned down in London, or 100 or 500, we haven't a clue, end quote. Korten mumbled, quote, we've put all our star agents onto it, end quote. These agents were in fact fictitious, the product of an Abwehr attaché's imagination. One relief to Hitler in this darkening month of December 1943 was the steadfast refusal of Turkey to declare war on Germany. Hitler, Ribbentrop, Himmler, and Papen were satisfied that the photocopies being furnished regularly by Cicero were authentic, angry telegrams classified as being, quote, of particular secrecy from, unquote, from Eden and Churchill, records of their secret meetings with Stalin at Tehran, and a letter from Allied headquarters in Cairo confirming that because of the German victory in the islands of Kos and Leros, operations in the Aegean had come to an abrupt end. The picture that emerged was of mounting and unremitting pressure by Britain on Turkey to enter the war by February 15th. Turkey was asked to prepare key airfields to accommodate 20 squadrons of RAF planes. Meanwhile, British submarines would enter the Black Sea to operate against the Crimea and the Romanian coastline. Turkey, however, saw no cause to help the hangman weave the noose. At their Cairo meetings, she realized Churchill and Eden had written off the Balkans and Eastern Europe to Stalin. Quote, the President Inonu returned from Cairo horrified, unquote, the Turkish foreign minister told Papen. Quote, and said that if he had seen this coming, he would never have gone there, end quote. Thanks to Cicero, Hitler was soon reading the British ambassador's enraged telegram to Churchill on December 13th, reporting that the Turks were demanding impossible amounts of armaments before they would agree to terms, a ploy familiar to the Führer from his dealings with the Italians. Eden accepted temporary defeat and cabled the following to his commander. Quote, to sum up, our object is to get Turkey into the war as early as possible, and in any case to maintain a threat to the Germans from the eastern end of the Mediterranean, until Overlord is launched. We still have not given up the idea that our squadrons should fly in on the 15th of February. End quote. Overlord was evidently the code name for the 1944 invasion in the West. Quote, there's not the slightest doubt that the attack will come in the spring, none whatever, end quote. As the Turkish foreign minister said to Papen imploringly, quote, we are at the most critical pass in our recent history, but since the Balkans are to be sacrificed to the Russians, we have no alternative but to keep playing our hand the way we are doing in the hope that German Eastern Front holds firm, end quote. This was the political significance of the Crimea in Hitler's eyes. Quote, the Finns can't just jump overboard. When all's said and done, they will still have to defend themselves, end quote. Not so Turkey, Bulgaria, and Romania. Stalin recognized this too, for his main winter offensive when it opened on December 24th was against the 4th Panzer Army's sector west of Kiev, the left shoulder of Manstein's army group. Manstein besought Hitler to gain 12 divisions by giving up the uneconomic quote-unquote bulge along the Black Sea and the bridgehead at Nikopol, while there was still time. Politically, this would be disastrous. But even militarily, Hitler doubted whether Manstein was right. He was enraged by the quote-unquote white lies in Manstein's telegram. it spoke of German quote-unquote counter-operations, where it meant quote-unquote decamping, and it vaguely observed, quote, we might hope that the enemy, unquote, unquote, Hitler angrily lectured Zietzler, quote, the enemy is not going to do what we hope, but what will damage us the most, unquote. Manstein, he said, was acting as if his army group was the orphan of the Eastern Front. In fact, since October, Hitler had sent him 5 first-class panzer divisions and 3 infantry divisions. Quote, if his troops are badly demoralized, then it's because of the spirit permeating them from above, end quote. When the field marshal warned that there were 47 Soviet infantry divisions and 9 tank corps confronting him, Hitler refused to acknowledge that these could be anything but worn-out divisions which had been, quote-unquote, reconditioned and fed back to the battlefields. With heavy sarcasm, he commented, quote, our German divisions are, quote, all rotten formations, unquote. The Russians are all, quote, fresh as daisy, unquote, and end quote. Quote, if we retire here, he said, then this, presumably jabbing at the Crimea on the map, is lost, end quote. Zietzler blurted out, quote, the Crimea is as good as lost anyway sooner or later, end quote. Hitler disagreed. Quote, I'll think it over during the night again. You know, Zietzler, we can all put on airs and say it's as good as lost. But when the time comes and it is lost, it won't be Manstein who accepts the blame. The responsibility is ours. They, the British, are trying to blackmail Turkey into joining the war on February 15th, he reminded Zietzler. Herr Manstein won't take any responsibility for that. He'll just say, quote, that's a matter for the politicians, unquote, and end quote. In addition, if Antonescu lost his army in the Crimea, he might be overthrown. Quote, that is why we are duty-bound to defend this second Stalingrad if at all possible, end quote. For many nights, Hitler worried over the strategic decision. He asked Zietzler early on December 29th to work out how many divisions Kukler could release to Manstein if Army Group North was withdrawn to the East Wall line. Admiral Dönitz, however, voiced empathetic protests on January 5th, 1944. Hitler forbade any voluntary withdrawal. The consequence was then that the Russian offensive began there 9 days later. Kukler's weakened army group was thrown back into the East Wall line anyway. Kukler was replaced by General Model, Hitler's stoutest defensive expert, and he halted the Soviet onslaught. As for the Allies, the end of 1943 saw Hitler completely ignorant of their intentions. A regular participant in the war conferences, Captain Heinz Assmann, his name is literally Assmann, summarized on December 29th, quote, the questions occupying the Führer and Wehrmacht operations staff now are primarily these. One, is all the Anglo-American huffing and puffing about an invasion in the West, speeches, articles, new appointments, and newspaper retorts really serious, or just an immense bluff to dupe Germany and perhaps Russia, too? Are they trying to lure its units away from the Eastern Front, or to prevent us from reinforcing that front in the crucial moment of the Soviet winter offensive? Two, is the invasion ballyhoo a diversion for a major operation in the Balkans, either via Crete, Rhodes, and the Aegean, or via Turkey, or both? Three, is the invasion planned not for the West, but perhaps in Denmark, Norway, after all? Four, is Turkey as reliable as she seems, or has she already resigned herself to the passage of British troops and the use of her airfields? Five, can we hold on to the Ukraine, which is vital for feeding the German people, where we can still cut back on the strength to help the worst pressure points on the Eastern Front? Or where can we still cut back on the strength to help the worst pressure points on the Eastern Front? Where is the first infallible clue as to their real invasion intentions? Six, will the U-boat campaign with the new submarine types result in the desired successes? End quote. Recent naval events had greatly enhanced Dönitz's standing at the Wolf's Lair, despite their disastrous outcome. Once again, the Navy had shown an aggressive spirit which Hitler sadly missed in his field marshals. On Sunday, December 26th, the battleship Scharnhorst had attacked an Allied convoy in the Arctic. But at 7:35 p.m., Dönitz telephoned Hitler to report that British warships had picked up Scharnhorst while still 30 miles off and had evidently destroyed her. An hour earlier, Berlin had monitored the bewildered Rear Admiral Bay, signaling, quote, "Finish her off with torpedoes. Fire a star shell. Clear the target area except for those ships with torpedoes and one destroyer with searchlight." End quote. Hitler accepted the warship's loss philosophically. If the enemy's radar was so good, then Scharnhorst had been like a blind man boxing with a prize fighter. Hitherto, German radar research had been controlled by Goering. It was a conspicuous failure. Under pressure from Speer and Dönitz at the Wolf's Lair on January 2nd, Hitler now transferred it to Speer's control. In the bitter, protracted contest that the war had now become, with four-fifths of the fighting front recruited from German civilian life, Hitler recognized that political indoctrination was as important as material armament. By early 1943, troop morale was suffering, particularly from the frontline soldiers' uncertainty about the fate of his wife and family under the heavy British air raids. Hitler expected his generals to explain the purpose of the struggle to their men. He had addressed them assembled by Bormann for this purpose at the Wolf's Lair on October 16th, and reassured them that he would not emulate the hated political commissar system of the Bolsheviks. He would elevate loyal and politically conscious officers to positions in which they could influence their comrades. There is no doubt that Hitler was finally impelled to issue his order of December 22, 1943, establishing an OKW National Socialist Leadership Staff by the subversion campaign being directed against the Eastern Front by the renegade German generals taken prisoner at Stalingrad. Quote, "The most dangerous developments at the front at this juncture," Hitler asserted later, "are definitely the proclamations printed by General Seydlitz. The proclamations arrive in black and white and red, the colors of the Reich, and the ordinary soldier can't tell what's true and what isn't. Besides, our soldiers have always taken officers to be men of honor." End quote. The troops were completely deceived by trick photo montages published by these Moscow renegades. He appointed General Hermann Reinecke to set up a small fanatical leadership staff, but while these new party-indoctrinated quote-unquote leadership officers would undoubtedly influence the lower command levels, Hitler himself would have to speak to the senior generals. At first he hesitated, saying, quote, "It would be hard to bring them all together at the same time," unquote. Bormann, however, was eager, quote, "If it could be done, it would be the biggest success," end quote. Keitel suggested that they would have to appoint a specially capable, quote-unquote, leadership officer for the army. Hitler replied without hesitation, quote, "Schorner, he is a fanatic," end quote. Until recently, commander of the bridgehead at Nikopol, Schorner was a tough general not given to defeatism. Only recently had he ended a letter to Schmunt with the words, quote, "You know the position here, but we will pull through." How different that was from the melancholy Manstein, who saw his fame as a commander withering before his eyes. Manstein arrived in agitation on January 4th, 1944, and again demanded permission to withdraw his entire southern sector. He embarked upon a forceful critique of Hitler's overall command in the east. Hitler tried to stare him down, but the field marshal could not be charmed. He recommended that Hitler appoint a commander-in-chief east. Hitler pointed out that nobody had as much authority as he had, quote, and even I am not obeyed by my field marshals. Do you think they would obey you or any better?" End quote. He could offer Manstein no fresh divisions. In the west, they must first wait until the invasion had been defeated, or the British had got bogged down in Portugal. His latest IDEFIXE. Hitler explained to Manstein that he was fighting to gain time. Time for the U-boat campaign beginning on May 4th. In May 1944, to bite. Time for the smoldering east-west dispute to blaze up into the open and returned him to the front. In the event Manstein's soldiers were able to withstand the winter onslaught, yielding almost no ground to the Russians. In the event Manstein's soldiers were able to withstand the winter onslaught, yielding almost no ground to the Russians. Okay. "Where there was a will," Hitler concluded, "there was evidently a way." During these first days of 1944, Hitler laid down the material foundations of the coming year's campaign. He personally besought Dönitz, Speer, and their submarine experts to keep their production targets. He had instructed Goering to concentrate production effort on the jet aircraft, and he ordered jet engine production to be housed underground at the Central Works tunnel factory already producing A-4 rockets near Nordhausen. On January 4th, he again told Speer and Milch how much he was relying on the new secret U-boat types and the jet aircraft. Quote, "If I get the jets in time, I can fight off the invasion with them. And again, if I get a few hundred of them to the front line, it will exorcise the specter of invasion for all time." End quote. Germany somehow had to raise more than 4 million new workers. The whole afternoon was devoted to a conference between Keitel, Speer, Milch, and Herbert Bacca, agricultural minister, as the quote-unquote employers, and Sockel and Himmler as the quote-unquote manpower procurers. Hitler was still loath to employ female workers on a scale comparable to Russia, Britain, and the United States, explaining that there was no comparison between, quote, our long-legged, slender women and the stocky, primitive, and robust Russian women, end quote. Sockel was banking on using Italian forced labor, but once again the Italian problem, the quote-unquote Italian problem, thwarted Hitler. To please Mussolini, he had agreed to the raising of a modest new Italian army. 4 divisions. The Italian internees had only to volunteer for these to escape labor service. The only ray of sunshine in this darkness had been Mussolini's unexpected arrest of Count Ciano. Together with his, quote-unquote, fellow conspirators, Ciano was tried and condemned to death by a fascist court in Verona in January. His wife, Edda, Mussolini's daughter, managed to escape to Switzerland, having addressed this letter to Hitler. Quote, "Führer, twice I believed your word and twice I have been cheated. Only the soldiers lying on the battlefields prevent me from deserting to the enemy. If my husband is not released, nothing but that will stop me. For some time now, the documents have been held by people authorized to make use of them. If anything were to happen to my husband, me, my children, or my family." End quote. A similar letter had gone to Mussolini himself. Hitler took no action to intervene, and Ciano, bound to a chair, met the fascist firing squad at 9 a.m. on January 11th. The spectacular failure of the Allies to make any headway in Italy was a huge comfort to Hitler, since early September they had managed to advance only 40 kilometers, little more than 6 miles per month. While General Jodl maintained his instinctive fear for the Balkans for some months yet, Hitler concluded from the Cicero reports that he could safely draw on his Balkan contingents. On January 12th, the British Foreign Office had cabled in exasperation to the British ambassador in Ankara that Turkey was unlikely now to enter the war soon. Quote, "We must now concentrate our main effort on maintaining the threat to the Germans from the eastern Mediterranean," end quote. According to the Cicero documents, Britain's ambassador was informed that Turkey was required to enter the war at the same time as Overlord began. This finally convinced Hitler that enemy strategy in the Balkans would be limited to diversionary operations. The Turkish foreign minister, Minemensioglu, Newman, informed a furious British ambassador, quote, "We are not so stupid as to get dragged into a war against our own interests for the second time in 25 years, end quote. Ribbentrop instructed that 250,000 gold marks were to be paid to Cicero. It was a reward well spent. Hitler next saw Manstein on January 27th. At Schmunt's suggestion, he had summoned the principal generals from the Russian front. Row upon row, they sat before him in the dining room of a converted inn at the OKW Security Zone 2, near the Wolf's Lair. For 2 days over at Posen, these generals had listened to speeches by Goebbels, Rosenberg, and other party leaders. On just the previous day, Himmler had spoken quite frankly to them about what he had done with the Jews, and most of the offers had rewarded him with an ovation. And there's an asterisk relating to that. Quote, "We were all there in Posen," recalled one rear admiral, "when that old man told us how he had killed off the Jews. I can still recall precisely how he told us. If people ask me, 'Why did you have to kill off the children too?' then I can only say, 'I'm not such a coward that I leave for my children something I can do myself.' End quote. Rear Admiral Engel, CSDIC UK report SRGG 1167 in profile, blah, blah, blah. You can look this up yourself. But yeah,
that's a good point.
Now, after Morell had given Hitler the obligatory injections, they heard him lecture articulately, and if the shorthand record be taken as a guide, powerfully on war and nations, and on the influence of leadership and racial character on a nation's morale. He hinted at new torpedoes, new submarines, new radar equipment, and secret weapons which would turn the tide in their favor after May 1944. Until then, they must grimly hold out. For this National Socialist indoctrination, that same quote-unquote holy conviction that distinguished the Reich from the merely administrative structure that had been fascism in Italy, was indispensable. Toward the end of his speech, something incredible occurred. For the first time, he was loudly interrupted. He had just addressed this challenge to the generals. Quote, If the worst comes to worst, and I am ever abandoned as supreme commander by my people, I must still expect my entire officer corps to muster around me with daggers drawn, just as every field marshal or the commander of an army corps, division, or regiment expects his subordinates to stand by him in the hour of crisis. End quote. As he paused for effect, Manstein's voice came forward from the front row, loud and possibly reproachful. Quote, and so it will be, mein Führer! End quote. Hitler hoped at first that the field marshal had meant to reassure him of their loyalty, but Bormann told him the generals had interpreted the outburst otherwise, that the worst would indeed come to the worst. It was an interruption of exquisite ambiguity. And there's another note related here. It resulted, according to Schmutz's diary, in Manstein's eventual dismissal. Yeah, hard to tell if that was a positive or negative remark. Twice that day, both in his speech and in the private evening circle, Hitler again formulated his goal as winning for Germany the, quote, world domination, unquote, for which she was, quote-unquote, predestined. That night, he told Bormann of his unorthodox ideas for making good Germany's disastrous casualties. Hitler remarked that Germany's most important asset, the fertility of generations of German women, perhaps 3 or 4 million of them, would be wasted unless men could be found for them. Every sound German woman, married or not, must bear as many children as possible to safeguard Germany's future. Writers, poets, and artists must henceforth extol the unmarried mother animal breeding, the finest specimens of manhood must do their bit, and German womanhood must be educated to abandon their fanatical insistence on marital fidelity. Quote, a fetish they often ignore themselves until they are married, Hitler slyly observed. Otherwise, he argued, one day all of Europe would be overwhelmed by the Asiatic hordes of which the current Russian plague was a part. Quote, we must look at the population charts of Europe and Asia in 1850 and 1870 and 1900, said Hitler, and try to visualize what the map of 1945 will be, end quote. And end chapter.